Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is off on holidays this week. He will be back on deck next week. So his colleague at Insomnia Security, Mark Piper, is filling in for him, and he'll be along in just a minute to talk through the week's security news. This week's show is brought to you by Thinxt Canary. You can find more information on Canary at canary.tools. Haroon Mia and Adrian Sanabria from Thinxt recently did a keynote talk at the Virus Bulletin conference in London, titled "The Security Products We Deserve." It's a stinging critique of the security product lifecycle. Venture capital firms keeping stupid ideas alive, analyst firms being parasites, vendors not doing security testing on their equipment. Haroon and Adrian laid it all bare for the audience there, and we will be speaking to Haroon Mia about that keynote in this week's sponsor interview, which will run after this week's news segment with Mark Piper, which starts now. And Pipes, we've got a bit of a showstopper report to kick things off with here. Chris Bing at Reuters has done some, day two reporting on the WhatsApp lawsuit against NSO Group. And his sources are telling him NSO's customers have been using NSO tools to do like espionage stuff, like not counterterrorism and criminal investigations like we expected, but there are apparently stacks of like politicians and senior military personnel all over the place who've received notifications from WhatsApp that they got owned in this NSO campaign. And, you know, and a lot of those people are in US allied countries.
Yeah, people are using commercial off-the-shelf software on what looks like some potentially sensitive operations. One of the interesting things that came out of this report was, I guess, how rapidly the customers took to the WhatsApp exploit. So the reporting around the legal side says that there was effectively a two-week window. And I found it fascinating that, you know, it looks like they averaged about 100 victims a day of the implants in use straight away. So it looks like it went from zero to 100 straight away.
Yeah, it was a sweet exploit. So you kind of do expect that. But this could be really, really bad for NSO. And you know, some people were a little bit concerned about WhatsApp notifying people who'd been targeted by this exploit because, you know, they could have been cartel members or murderers or whatever. But apparently Facebook cross-checked the target phone numbers against like all the law enforcement requests it had received, and there was basically zero overlap. So this whole story is just wild. But back on the topic of this being bad for NSO, I spoke to Chris Bing about this story and asked him to tell us where all this will go, in his opinion, and here's what he said.
The reason this matters is that for so long, NSO-linked hacking efforts have been known to be aimed at human rights activists and other dissidents. But in this case, we really do have a concrete example of how NSO's technologies have gotten in the middle of nation-state on nation-state activity. And to that effect, you could imagine that that's where legislation, public call-outs, real government action could begin to happen. Because when your politicians in your own country are the ones affected, suddenly I think the legislative cycle comes a little faster.
So yeah, this is some crazy stuff. Wired is reporting that Facebook will probably have a hard time making this lawsuit stick. But meanwhile, Facebook has actually nuked the personal Facebook accounts of NSO staff on its platform. So the cyber knives have come out.
Yeah, I mean, scorched earth is the term that comes to mind. But effectively, I don't know what one should expect as collateral damage if you're working for an organization that's, you know, not only writing but deploying commercial exploits that are being used in the wild to target products. I think a little bit of blowback should be expected.
Yeah, now look, switching to some technology news now, and we've been expecting an RDP worm for a long time. We don't quite have an RDP worm. This is, of course, the so-called Bluekeep bug in RDP. We don't have a worm going around, but we do have some mass exploitation happening at the moment. But the good news is it's just being used to drop a cryptocurrency miner, which is pretty much the best case scenario, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit surprised that this news took so long. So it looks like over the last couple of weeks, some enterprising crypto miners have gone out and taken the Metasploit module that's been made public, and from the looks of it, running a very manual process of running down vulnerable servers and trying to exploit them, and then once on, loading their crypto miner. A pretty good example of one getting caught in the wild by a honeynet. So it looks like from the information that's been made public is they've been actively working for a couple of weeks, and it was Kevin Beaumont from the UK. His honeynet sort of picked it up, and he noticed that his RDP services were crashing, and he worked with Marcus Hutchins actually to pass over the crash dumps and run some analysis to verify that it's the Bluekeep exploit in play.
Yeah, well done all around on that. But, you know, it really is the case that these things don't turn into absolute horror shows until they start doing that automated sort of internal self-propagation, which is really what causes the damage, isn't it?
Yeah, and one does wonder if that's coming. I mean, there's still a lot of places out there internally which would be vulnerable to Bluekeep. So it'll be interesting to see what the timeline looks like. I think one of the interesting things out of this Bluekeep example is, I guess, the initial reaction through to time to exploit, through to time to being seen in the wild has been quite an interesting one. It's quite lengthy in time, and I think, you know, a lot of the MSRC and Microsoft security engineers will be feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, yeah. Ah, here we go. This one is some stunt hacking, but it's been doing the rounds. Everybody's talking about it because it is kind of cool. You can use lasers to inject like voice commands into Amazon Echoes and Google Home devices. This is pretty cool.
This is great. So yeah, effectively what they're saying is, you know, from a distance of up to sort of 75 meters, they've figured out that they can fire a laser at various microphones on smart devices and then modulate the laser accordingly to sort of trigger voice commands, such as, you know, one of the examples they have is opening a garage door. I found probably the most fascinating bit of the story is not so much the security implications, but the physics side of it, where, you know, they've outlined this attack, they've managed to get it to work, they've proven it in the wild, and they still have no idea why. They have no idea why it's effective and why it works. So
it's got to have something to do. It's got to be thermal, right? You would think.
Yeah, there seem to be a couple of theories about it, mostly around what sort of happens on the membrane itself for the microphone or the electronics behind the membrane on the microphone. But really it wasn't clear, and they've even straight up said, you know, we're not 100% sure what's happening here, but it's a pretty cool trick nonetheless. And it was a great example, I think, of accidental discovery in the lab. So if I recall correctly, one of the academics was sitting around in the lab and pointing a high-powered laser at his iPad and noticed that something happened. So that's always a great way for a scientific discovery.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's penicillin and then there's opening people's garage doors with lasers. Fantastic accidental discoveries. Now, some time ago, quite a while ago now, I think, what was it, last year? Adam and I spent a fair bit of time talking about this weird situation with Uber where essentially someone got a hold of a whole bunch of their data and then kind of ransomed it back to them. And then Uber's response to that was to say, sure, we'll give you your money, but you need to register with HackerOne with your real details. And the people did it. So then, of course, they dispatched members of their security team to get them to sign NDAs and I believe do forensic teardowns on their devices, and they kind of covered it up, right? Like they didn't mention it to regulators. This resulted in Uber eating a absolutely massive fine sometime after that. Now, it looks like the two people behind that attack, they hadn't just done it to Uber. They'd also done this to lynda.com. And they have just pled guilty to these crimes. So not looking real good for them.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those ones at the time that this is kind of interesting in the respect of the approach that Uber took, and that was what the focus was on at the, you know, when it went down. But yeah, it's really interesting. They must have had plenty of evidence because they straight up pled guilty. And, you know, it sounds like the approach they took was It's quoted as ran an elaborate ruse, which I'm not sure how elaborate the ruse was, but basically they targeted the GitHub account of developers and engineers at the target organizations. And then once they'd compromised GitHub, they were pulling out AWS keys, and then they went onwards into AWS to sort of hunt out some data to sort of, you know, put up asking for Bitcoin. So it seemed to be the MO on both of those cases. It wouldn't surprise me if this was done on more than just those two, but that was the two that they had solid evidence on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the vibe I was getting from people I knew at Uber at the time was that these guys were basically dumbasses, and, you know, they kind of doxed themselves through HackerOne to get their shakedown payment. So, yeah, I mean, I guess we'll wait for sentencing, but this whole chapter looks like it's drawing to a close. Didn't really work out well for anyone. The Imperva CEO is Gonski's. He had planned to stay on, but of course they had some trouble. They were breached, and I think we covered their post-breach write-up some time ago, but it looks like, yeah, bye-bye. This story by Jeff Stone at Cyberscoop seems to suggest that the departure of the CEO is linked to that breach having occurred.
Yeah, and as is tradition at the moment, right? Like whenever we see big breaches, it's not that long afterwards we start seeing senior executives leaving the business. I think it's really a sign of where accountability has to lay within security more and more. And I think it's hitting further and further up the chain. And the idea that you can just blame the security engineer or you can blame the system administrator seems to be a thing of the past.
Yes. Well, I'm sure Chris Hyland, the departed executive from Imperva, will just have to cry into his giant pile of Thoma Bravo money because they have acquired Imperva.
Yeah, he was meant to stay on through the merger, right?
So sad for him. Here's some more. Look, you know, we actually spoke about this before we started recording because I'm surprised this isn't, you know, this is kind of cool tech news. This is something that should have happened quite a while ago. Facebook, Mozilla, and Cloudflare have got together to announce TLS delegated credentials. It's like an extension to TLS, which enables you to like create temporary, like short-term TLS certificates that you can push out to like your CDN and stuff, so you don't actually have to push private key material out to the edge of, you know, your entire CDN setup. This makes a lot of sense. Like the way we've been doing things in terms of TLS termination and CDNs has been nuts for so long that I'm surprised something like this took this long.
Yeah, this is in with, you know, most of the modifications we've made to TLS over the years and the extensions that we've loaded in with hindsight perfectly simple and clear. And we're quite often left wondering, why didn't we do it sooner? And this is absolutely one of those things. And I think it's just a case of we're starting to hit distribution scales, like where there's been enough incidents and enough fear about the theft of TLS certificates and private keys from servers that we're now starting to really think through this problem. So it's really good to see this getting some engineering. So it's currently going through the Internet Engineering Task Force. But the idea effectively is if you're running, you know, 40,000 servers, rather than having to put those TLS secrets onto 40,000 servers, and in the event that one of them gets compromised, your certificates and keys are compromised, it sort of sets up an ephemeral temporary key onto each of the servers that may only be valid for hours, and then sort of delegates the trust through.
You can sort of be your own mini CA in a way, I guess.
Yeah, effectively, and it's very similar to, I guess, what we've seen with the sort of ACME structures. The idea is that the validity of the secrets is less, but the renewal cycle, being able to issue new ones onto the servers, is automated and therefore painless. So it really is designed for people who are managing, you know, a large number of front-end web servers, and that's your CDNs and your really large-scale sites. But yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting move to see this come through and what the adoption is for it.
Look, I think it's anyone using a CDN personally. I mean, I'd use this. I'm going to have to actually start using a CDN soon because, as regular listeners would know, when I post episodes, the first 10 minutes tend to get a little bit interesting for the old wood-fire, steam-powered Risky Biz server. But it just makes sense, I think, as a default standard use, you know, in any environment, especially when you're using a third-party CDN, right? Like, this just makes it better. It's cool.
It does. And one of the big concerns whenever you're deploying that sort of infrastructure is, you know, where the secrets lie and what the window of opportunity is for man-in-the-middle attacks in the event that they're compromised.
Yeah.
And for the larger players, you know, that's a really big deal. Like, I mean, if I was targeting Mozilla, for example, getting some of their certificates would be very useful for conducting attacks against, you know, their users in certain countries and certain locations, or even certain corporates, right? So it's being able to reduce that window of opportunity that the attackers can get those certificates and keys and then conduct such attacks is pretty good.
Now, it turns out Montenegro has a bit of a Russian interference problem when it comes to its elections. So the US European Command and US Cyber Command are sending a bunch of people over to Montenegro to get insight into what sort of interference they might experience there so that they can then bring that knowledge back to the United States ahead of the 2020 election. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting and novel way to go about getting some TDPs for what the current attacks are. I mean, one of the things that we learned last year was they put boots on the ground, and I think it was in Ukraine around the last election there, to try to understand what the patterns and behaviours for not just sort of influence campaigns, but also for voter suppression and various other sort of tasks that they undertook against those elections. So we don't know what came of those, you know, quote unquote, boots on the ground on that gathering exercise, but clearly it was something useful because they've gone straight back out and done it again in the next sort of major hotspot.
Yeah. And meanwhile, there's a bit of an election security drill happening in the United States as well.
Yeah, this is interesting. So this is really a sort of tabletop exercise that's being undertaken. And the idea is that a red team is going to sort of mimic the influence operations and the voter suppression campaigns that they saw during the last US election, and try to walk through what that would look like if it was discovered in the wild across the next election, and sort of improving those communication lines across agencies and various commissions.
Yeah, it's interesting because these tabletop exercises, some people might say, oh, you know, what use is that going to be? But I knew some people who quite some time ago participated in those Cyberstorm exercises here in Australia. And, you know, everyone I've spoken to who was involved in them said that they were tremendously useful because the gaps in where you go when X happens, you know, you might say, well, we don't actually have any plan for that. We don't even know who to call. So the deficiencies in what you would do in situation X become readily visible. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I was personally involved in one of the Cyberstorms, and it's an interesting place to be because effectively, generally, when you're looking at this sort of behavior or these sort of exercises, you're dealing with technical subject matters, but the people involved in the exercise aren't technical. So what you do is you learn a lot around how to communicate the, you know, I guess the importance or relevance or the behavior of various sort of technical aspects into the decision makers and policy makers that need to undertake some sort of action or make some sort of decision, and cutting through the confusion and understanding how to talk to each other and getting the common language and how to sort of push that through in a time of extreme importance is very useful to have up front.
We got some reporting here from Ars. This story was also written up by ZDNet. It turns out that, yeah, if you want to ransomware a whole bunch of people and make all of your bitcoins, a good way to do that is to own managed service providers. I suppose this is kind of quite obvious, really, that they would be great targets for ransomware crews. But we've seen some studies come out that certainly support that theory.
Yeah. So from what I can tell with this, Armor were looking at the sort of, you know, MSP landscape, and they'd seen a couple of examples of MSPs being used to conduct further attacks, primarily ransomware, against the MSP customers. And so they've gone and undertaken a fair chunk of effort to go and correlate and aggregate the various different incidents that are out there. And they're not saying that there's one threat actor behind them, but basically they're saying, you know, this is very much a trend and across sectors that you wouldn't necessarily expect. You know, we think of MSPs a lot of the time as managing the desktops and managing day-to-day operation tasks, but some of the MSPs here are in quite interesting verticals, you know, relating to airline specific sort of stuff and various other sort of sub-industries. So I guess the breadth of the incidents and what they've gathered up there is very much showing a clear pattern.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of companies now that make software for managed service providers who are all of a sudden starting to focus a great deal more on security. So I think there are some improvements in the tool chain for MSPs coming down the line. And I just hope that they're enough to kind of improve this, because it certainly doesn't feel like the momentum in these types of ransomware attacks is subsiding. Let's put it that way. Nikkei, the Japanese conglomerate, its US subsidiary or its US arm got taken in a business email compromise scam to the tune of $29 million. Apparently authorities in the United States and Hong Kong have been notified, which might suggest that Hong Kong is where the money wound up. But geez, $29 million. Why bother with ransomware when you can just, you know, get yourself an inbox and walk away with millions?
Yeah, I mean, this is just another great example of an article where you want to see more detail. Obviously, they're not releasing much information at this time, but I think one of the trends that we've seen recently is targeting systems and getting 50 million accounts is one thing, but targeting people and processes and walking away with 29 million in hard cash is something else, right?
Yeah.
And so they seem to be a little bit more high risk and they seem to involve a little bit more setup, but the risk reward seems to be there for them still. And it's still a classic problem of securing people and processes is hard, especially when they're non-technical, right? In this case, it was a financial transaction. I'm sure that it looked like a standard financial transaction. I'm sure that it looked like a standard request to change the account number. And it's still a very hard problem to tackle.
Now, I know I've spoken about this on Twitter. I'm not sure. I think I've mentioned it on the show, but I recently moved house and, you know, out of the old into the new. And I'm in the process of selling my old house. And this is when my work-related paranoia is going into hyperdrive because, you know, when someone buys my house, it looks like it's going under contract soon. You know, when that settles, there's going to be a fair amount of money moving about the place. And I've got to talk to my solicitor at some point about actually putting things in the contract saying that you will confirm by phone the account numbers involved in the settlement, because it is such a legal nightmare, really, this business email compromise fraud, particularly as it relates to complicated transactions like house settlements. But it's just when you start thinking about how this crime type could touch you, you realize that it's quite hard to sort of insulate yourself from it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, the whole, I guess, real estate industry is a great example of it, where we have seen numerous cases over and over again of settlement fraud over and over again. So, yeah, it's a case of, you know, on the one hand, we deal with technology and computers a lot of the time, but on the other hand, a lot of the business world lives on their inbox, and that's where the business is done.
Yeah. Indeed. We've got a write-up here of a report that was put together by WordFence, and a lot of details in here.
Yeah, someone's been busy. So effectively, WordFence have put out a report looking into the WPVCD WordPress hacking crew. They've been in operation for quite some time and have sort of updated and changed their tactics over time. But, you know, effectively, the MO is they have an extremely good SEO operation that sort of pushes their own plugin sites above all of the sort of main popular ones, and especially for popular plugins, they will get their search links to the top. And then once installed on the WordPress instance, it will install a backdoor user and allow full takeover of the WordPress deployment. And then they're sort of using that to monetize through malvertising and stuff. The report also goes into, you know, trying to understand who's behind it. And there's a couple of interesting bits in there around some, you know, I guess not so great OPSEC in some respects, and who they think is behind it, and sort of the history of that person going through the process.
Yeah, so I've linked through to the article in this week's show notes, and there is a link at the end of that article to the full report should anyone care to read it. This one is cool. Like, I first caught this on Twitter a few weeks ago because it was presented at that FireEye conference. And my God, I got to say, just by monitoring like Twitter during that conference, there was a lot of good stuff that got presented there. When, you know, it's pretty cool when, you know, you've got essentially all those Mandiant folks, you know, going and talking about their most the most interesting stuff that they're allowed to talk about. And hoo boy, there was some cool stuff there. But one of those cool things was this bit of malware that is used to tap SMS messages on telco servers. Just a really nice case study here of some very specific purpose malware.
Yeah, they're calling it Message Tap, and it's one of those cases where you look at the malware and go, this makes perfect sense. So generally it targeted an SMSC, so an SMS center inside a telecommunications provider. An SMSC's job is to effectively act as a router for SMS messages. So when messages comes in, it tries to figure out, you know, where they have to go, which networks they have to split out onto, whether or not it has to go off to hand into further into the cell network to deliver to handsets. In general, SMSCs are straight up Linux boxes. They're nice big fat Linux boxes. They often run sort of Erlang and various other sort of, you know, high transaction in memory languages. And in this case, China went ahead and worked on a bit of malware that effectively used libpcap to monitor the traffic in and out of the SMSCs, look for keywords or look for specific phone numbers or IMSIs, and then sort of, you know, encrypt and save copies of all of those messages for later pickup on disk. And it seems to have been, I would imagine, reasonably effective.
Yeah. I'd imagine every major power would have a bit of malware like this, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those ones that we would have expected to have seen in the NSA leaks, right? Like, yeah. I would imagine it's if you're wanting to get in bulk messages from telco cores or telecommunications providers, this is exactly where you'd do it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, QNAP NAS devices are having a pretty bad time. And, you know, I recently set up a fresh backup system at home with a NAS. And, you know, you're going through the setup and it's like, here, would you like a dynamic DNS entry so that you can access all your files from the internet? It's just like, no, I would not like that, actually. But yeah, this is the thing. People are still connecting their NASs to the internet and this sort of thing is happening.
It's the cloud in your house, right? Like people want that. And so it's an interesting one. They say 7,000 infections.
Just in Germany. That's just in Germany.
It's not really clear what the vector is or anything and sort of, you know, how it's sort of spreading, I guess, at the moment. But what they do say is that a firmware update has been dropped. So someone's clearly been busy responding to this and making sure that, you know, it sort of gets a update pushed out before more details on the vulnerability get out there. But it'll be interesting to see what the approach was that they took and sort of what the vector was.
Yeah, we've seen ransomware affecting Synology devices as well and a bunch of stuff affecting QNAP. It's just, I don't know, it's surely it can't be that hard to just keep it on your LAN, you know? just my opinion there. Unless it's some sort of cross-site scripting or, you know, cross-site request forgery thing affecting the interface. What could it be, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, generally on these ones, it's exposing something out. Yeah,
that's what I would have thought.
You know, getting a large number of successful CSRF attacks in to target people would be, you know, I'm not really aware of a huge case, a great example of that. Whereas, you know, maybe it's shipped with a vulnerable Samba module or something like that. It seems more likely.
Yeah, and then just put out onto the internet. That makes sense. Now, this one's a cyber event. Is this a cyber event? We've got it's kind of a funny story, actually. I mean, a Utah-based renewable energy company had to report a cyber event to the Department of Energy in the United States, but the cyber event itself was a bit of a comedy show, actually.
Yeah. So, effectively, there was this quote unquote cyber event. When you look into the details, someone ran a denial of service against the checkpoint firewalls for the provider. And while that doesn't seem like a big deal because they operate a network and they have a control network, the control network wasn't quote unquote affected. However, they couldn't talk to the control network because they were DOSed offline. So as a result, they had to raise it up. They sought assistance and got told by Cisco to patch their firewalls because there were known vulnerabilities. So they went ahead and did that and no more problem.
Yeah, so it was a Cisco firewall. You did actually say checkpoint initially, but Cisco. That's all good. But it was a Cisco firewall. And, you know, the thinking seems to be that it might have just been someone doing like a mass scan for that bug and just like accidentally DOSing them. And now it's wound up in a Department of Energy report.
Yeah, any event will do to sort of raise the profile as well, right? Like, I mean, I know from experience that we worry so much about ICS that it becomes a hot topic that any incident in ICS must be a malicious one. But sometimes, you know, it is really basic and stuff happens when you have it on the internet.
Also, way to go, Cisco, for having firewalls that you can DOS. That's awesome. Ubisoft, the game maker, has found a novel approach at making DDoS campaigns against its game servers go away. They managed a 93% drop in DDoS attacks against their infrastructure by sending cease and desists to like DDoS for hire companies. Who knew that this would be so effective?
This is amazing. Effectively on Rainbow Six Siege, they decided it was time to reset the player rankings. As they did that, a bunch of players decided that they could get further up the rankings faster if they DOS the servers and cause latency for everyone else. So they set about doing that quite busily. After about a week or so of being, you know, knocked offline continuously, Ubisoft got a little bit grumpy about it and pulled out their lawyers and sent cease and desist letters to the DDoS for hires as well as the people they could figure out who actually, you know, commissioning
the services
and a 93% drop. So
who knew? I don't think that'll work in every instance, but it's pretty funny because you wouldn't expect something like that to be quite that effective.
I mean, you don't want to have to go to your parents explaining that you're getting sued because you're trying to move up the Rainbow Six Siege rankings, right?
Yeah, it would be a little bit. Probably going to get grounded after that, you would think. Krebs is reporting that there's been a breach at networksolutionsregister.com and web.com, and I'm wondering why this isn't bigger news.
Yeah, I think the reason why it isn't bigger news is because there isn't a whole lot more detail at the moment. And I expect Krebs and a couple of other journalists are probably off running this one down now. But effectively, web.com came out with a notice saying you know, we've been compromised. You need to change your passwords. And due to their ownership of Registrar.com and Network Solutions, that sort of onflows down to the customers in that area as well. But there's actually very little amount of detail as to what's gone on, other than, you know, there's been some unauthorized access and some passwords compromised.
Yeah. So this, we might just throw that in the possibly developing story basket for now. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things we know from experience is targeting registrars is extremely useful for attackers. And there was even that case earlier this year where I think it was the Iranians were running around, like, you know, modifying the glue records on DNS to be able to then say, actually, were you a VPN server now or were you a DNS server now for organizations? So, yeah, there's a lot of potential vectors that could occur as a result of compromising those, and to have it so quietly tucked away and yeah, not much detail is interesting.
Yes, I had the same reaction. So let's keep an eye on that one. Meanwhile, MITRE looks like it's going to expand the attack framework to cover ICS gear as well. We had Jake King on the show last week talking about how, you know, MITRE attack is sort of expanding to cover container environments and things like that. So it looks like attack is really, you know, at full steam now.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. One of the things that attack has given us is, I think you described it once, as common language to be able to talk through what the attacker's techniques and procedures actually are, as well as tools. And having, I guess, a common framework that allows us to sort of help explain to clients and to people who may be affected by attacks what an attack actually looks like in 2019 has been largely due to the attack framework. So being able to take that out to ICS and being able to say, you know, it's more than just firewalls and antivirus. These are the sort of techniques and these are the approach that attackers are using. And having a common ground to sort of walk through that seems very useful.
Yep. We got one from Lily Hay Newman at Wired here. Google is apparently developing their equivalent of like Apple's T2 chip. It's like a secure enclave, which I'm guessing is going to wind up on a bunch of its computers, its computer products. And it's a open source. It looks like it's going to be an open source standard, which, you know, you were schooling me on this earlier, that that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, one of the things that Apple has, I guess, to its advantage in some degree is that it can manufacture its own hardware and has that tight coupling between software and hardware. For the rest of people out there and rest of organizations out there, we still rely a lot on, you know, sourcing from multiple vendors and coming up with, I guess, boards that are consisting of various different chips and components through multiple vendors. And in instances where we want to improve trustworthy computing, and that's in data centers right down through to end user devices, you know, the chips are becoming increasingly important, and the security of the secrets and computing secrets is becoming increasingly important. So having an open standard and an open platform that, you know, we can sort of call on, I guess, as an industry that everyone agrees is sort of above board and on the right track and can be manufactured to specifications, like open source specifications, helps improve the trust in those chipsets and the processing we're doing on them.
Paige Thompson, the suspect who has been charged over the Capital One breach, it looks like she was due to be released on bail today. It looks like the judge, Robert Lasnik, had looked into the effect of incarceration on trans inmates and basically come to the conclusion that she was at high risk and has allowed her to be released back into the community pending her trial.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this is going to be one of those cases that takes quite a bit of time to work through. She pled not guilty. They claim there's 30 terabytes of evidence that they have to work through and sort of build the case on, and that's obviously going to be a lengthy process. So being able to, I guess, focus on health, mental health, while going through that seems positive.
An interesting note in the story is that she is banned from visiting any Capital One or Amazon owned locations, including Whole Foods. So that is a shame. She will have to find somewhere else to buy her fresh vegetables. Oh, this is interesting. Huawei is running a bug bounty in Munich for its new mobile devices. And this is like its Harmony OS, which is its Android competitor. It's invited a whole bunch of people to come and hack on it in Munich.
Yeah, it's something they've been working actively on for some time now, is trying to bolster the security of their platform, and with Harmony OS coming out as well as their existing range with Android, it makes sense that they're going to try to entice the best hackers around to work on it.
Yeah, so it looks like they will be getting people to hack away on Harmony OS and on Android. And it is interesting, right? Because as much trouble as Huawei is having with Western markets, it's not like the company's just going to disappear. It won't. Okay, Pipes, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks a lot for filling in for Adam Boileau. It's always great to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed it, and I'll speak to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pat.
That was Mark Piper there from Insomnia Security with a chat about the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir, the founder of Thinxt Canary. Thinxt makes simple and effective deception technology. They have their flagship product, which is the hardware Canary, which is basically a simple configurable honeypot you can just put on your network. You make it look like whatever you want. So when an attacker is on your network and they start interacting with it, you know something is up. Now, in a world where the average time to detect an attacker in your network is something like around the 200-day mark, having a honeypot that can bring that down to 1 or 2 days is going to be pretty bloody useful. And they're cheap too, right? So this is a simple thing that's cheap. Thinxt also operates like an integrated Honey Token service. There are cloud canaries as well. They got all sorts of stuff. But the key is it's all simple stuff. They don't try to blow up malware in their new custom sandbox that they capture stuff with their deception technology. They don't try to use their tech to trigger orchestrated responses that will probably just end up DOSing you somehow. Their whole mantra is simple, simple, simple. Now, with this in mind, Haroon and his colleague, Adrian Sanabria, they did the keynote at the recent Virus Bulletin conference in London just the other week, and they used the stage to really have a dig at the wider security industry. They gave both barrels to the traditional venture capital model, which they say is often funding the wrong stuff and then keeping it alive when it should be allowed to wither and die. They also took aim at analysts, industry awards, the lack of security testing companies actually do on their products, and so much more. It's a pretty brutal talk. And while I think they may have exaggerated elements here and there, it's otherwise pretty much bang on target. I've linked through to the talk on YouTube so that you can watch it yourselves, and I recommend that you do. Haroon joined me for this conversation, and I started off by asking him if it's the investors who are to blame for pushing technology that's too damn complicated. I mean, this was one of his central complaints. He's like, this stuff is just too elaborate. Here's what Haroon had to say about that.
It's not just investors. Like I think investors stick out because they then fund all these companies. And so you end up with lots of companies that are kind of the sorts of companies that investors would pick. But in truth, it's even customers. Like in general, customers feel okay buying complex stuff when most networks need relatively simple stuff. And people just feel better buying super whiz-bang stuff than they do buying really simple solutions. And I suspect it's part of the reason why we end up with networks that have lots of ridiculously complex should catch APT10, and actually people haven't changed local passwords forever because nobody's installed a tool to fix the local password problem when they should have.
It's interesting, right? Because I mean, I face this myself because we have to select sponsors to appear on the show. And I have let some of these people who make really elaborate solutions come onto the show. Quite often, I think there are some users out there who are going to get some benefit from it, right? Which is, maybe that's just my way of justifying having them on. But I think by and large, you're right. It's the simple stuff that's going to work. I mean, that's why the stuff that I'm increasingly a fan of, you know, it's stuff like CMD doing some really basic, pseudo permission sort of stuff on Linux. It's things like Duo, right? It is the basic blue collar security stuff that tends to get you the furthest.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is there's certainly complex problems that will need PhDs and need complex solutions. But I think if you look at those products that you just mentioned, what you'll notice is that all of them come out of practitioners. So what you'll see is it's practitioners going, actually, here's the thing that needs solving. And then they take a thing and say, well, here's what it's going to take to make this particular problem go away. And yeah, I think those things need support. Interestingly, I think the market's going there on its own.
Yeah.
Like I think the super complex, this product can just about fly the shuttle. I think people are now realizing that, look, we've bought 10 of those and they just sit in the back on the shelf and nobody's fully installed it. It doesn't work in these situations, as opposed to this is simple and it works, let's do it. I think you're naturally starting to see those things win out. But never make the mistake of thinking simple isn't hard. Like, yeah. Simple's crazy, exactly. Crazy difficult to do. And again, I think it comes down to when you're a practitioner, like if you're an HD Moore and you've built Rumble, or Zane Lackey and team and you've built Signal Sciences, you've spent enough time in the trenches to go, yes, we could include AI dark market foo, but that's not what this needs. And there's a combination of having the time in the industry to say, we don't want to go there, and a little bit of courage to go, yeah, we can make this work without ticking those boxes.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's, and I think that misses when you are a random guy who starts a company because the sector is hot and because a VC will back you. Because at that point, you're going to add every harebrained thing that comes along, which is why, like if you look at the other deception guys, like you'll see at some point they've gone down, let's explode malware, let's do this. And they were doing it because at the time, FireEye was hot. So FireEye is hot and FireEye explodes malware. So
we're a sandbox company now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a big thing there, like if we're not just talking investors, is part of what's worked for the complex guys till now is that they weren't selling to the people on the ground.
No, like, they're selling board level with the airport ads and stuff.
Exactly. And that's why complexity works, because if you're selling to the purchasing department, you're selling based on the number of sales guys you have in blue suits that are able to do multiple meetings and all of that stuff, as opposed to does this stuff work?
But I don't think you can blame the InfoSec industry for companies running shitty procurement programs, because that's a problem that is as old as time. I do want to touch on a couple of other things that you mentioned in the talk, and there's one of them, because I guess when I was watching it, I'm like, this is all sounding pretty familiar, right? But I guess, you know, there's a lot of people listening to this who don't necessarily know, you know, who haven't dared peek inside the sausage factory. And while I think you've exaggerated some components of it, I think it is a pretty depressingly accurate overview. One thing that you did mention is that it's a bit of a dirty secret of the InfoSec products industry is that most vendors and startups, they don't actually do security testing on their products.
It's like that bit's shocking. It's so you're right, like most people don't know it, and I'm reasonably surprised that more people don't push back. Especially since over the last few years, you started to see egregious cases of brokenness. And like, you've seen really smart people talking about it for a while that says, hey, you're taking a complex problem and you're adding millions of lines of code in a privileged position, like this will only end badly for you. And most times the stuff just slips by. And to go to the overall theme of the talk, part of what I'm saying is these startups, it's not like they're not spending money. So sometimes you go and you look like, why didn't they spend on security testing their own stuff? They are spending on the airport ads and they are spending on the coin-operated salespeople. They just don't believe that they have to spend on actually building a secure product.
See, this is the thing. This is the thing, though. I can't figure out if you're trying to fix the InfoSec industry or fix capitalism generally, right? That's kind of the problem here.
yeah.
You know, corporations doing stupid stuff and allocating resources to the wrong thing. It's like, well, you know, that's kind of
optimistic enough. I'm optimistic enough to want to fix it all. So in general, I think, and I say that in joke, but I kind of think it's true. I think. You're starting to see the pushback where people go, it's unacceptable that you introduce risk to my business. So you better not suck, or not egregiously suck. And in part, like part of the reason for the talk, the bit that's aimed at young startups is a thing that says, hey, listen, you can get a jump on this. Like actually save some of the money you're going to spend on a $1 million RSA boot and pay someone to actually test the architecture, test the code of your application.
One thing that drives me nuts about this is that these products are actually being tested, and they're being tested by the people who are looking to buy them, right? So Adam, you know, Adam Boileau's business, Insomnia Security, they do actually a fair bit of testing of vendor kit, but it's never for the vendor. It's always for someone who's thinking about buying that technology. Like, why should it be up to the client to do that? I don't get that.
Yeah, it's that thing is broken, and the part that sucks, like again, that we've seen personally, is some people just make terrible architectural decisions. Like architecturally, what they're planning is never going to be sound.
And Linux
and
on MIPS.
Just go like, yeah, it gets so much worse. And yeah, for the most part, there, I'm just saying no. Like, we need to do better. And what I'm hopeful for is that much like a little while back, nobody needed to add good UX to their products. Like, you could get away with it sucking. But increasingly, at least reasonable UX is a minimum bar.
But I think that had to happen. And that's why people are not so focused necessarily on being end-to-end in their products. Like, they're like, hey, you know, we're just an API and you can pump that into your seam. Like, that's everybody now. It's like, we just have to find this data. And I think that is a positive change, because then it's like, okay, we're focusing on pumping good quality data into a seam at low volume, high signal to noise.
I totally do. And you're saying an interesting thing here, because you'll find, and it's a good seg, because what you'll find is it bumps against the conventional wisdom that for a while has been saying, there's too many products. What you need is consolidation. And I agree that there's too many products.
Yeah, but what you want is interoperability, right? And that's what exactly. We're kind of starting to see. And it's one of those things that I'm kind of encouraged by as well, because I'm guessing for a lot of your users, they're never logging into your web interface, right? Like, you're pumping high priority alerts into a seam, right? That's it. Job
exactly
done.
Right.
Use the API. And that's great.
Yeah, it's exactly the way. It's the Unix way, right? It's things that interact, things that are simple. They do their job well, and then they push the information along to someone else who wants to do stuff.
What's really funny about this is we're discussing your talk, which was a critique about how awful the InfoSec industry is, and I tricked you into talking about positive developments.
No. The talk is surprisingly positive also. Like I'm hopeful. I see new hope with the younger companies, and more than anything, I want to encourage young startups to say, actually, there is a better way. Like it's in the past, I'd concede that doing it right made it harder for you to survive. Like, if you went and decided to make a secure product while someone else was just pumping out features, you'd lose to them in the marketplace. And now I'm saying, actually, that's not so true anymore. Like, in the old days, if you built what you thought was right and someone else built what the VC thought was right, VCs had enough jet fuel to give those products.
Yeah, the VC product would win, right? It's not about the best tech, it's about the best sales and marketing. I think that's still true to an extent. One thing I like, though, is when you were talking about pushing back on customers who are like, hey, can we use your canary across like these two VLANs? And you're just like, no. You cannot. And it's like, oh, you know, why don't you use it on your bloody air gap? You know, like, that's just dumb. It's a dumb idea, right? But this is how we wind up with bloatware in security is, you know, one company asks for a feature and then they ship it to everyone.
Exactly right. And everyone feels that they've got to do it. And then people are just building by consensus and by checklist. And so at that point, everyone's just like, well, sure, we'll include this untested XML parser in our code because we need XML output. And it all the badness comes from people just competing badly.
All the badness comes from people competing badly. Pithy. Now look, you know, it's my opinion that we could see, because there is a lot of dumb stuff being funded. I mean, it's something that, you know, we said in the lead up to the last shakeout, right? And it eventually catches up. There's either, you know, there's consolidation, right. Then a lot of companies just sort of wither and die. I think that's coming again because there's so many companies out there. Like, I know what some of these companies are making, like in terms of revenue, and I know how much money's gone in, and it's like that equation isn't looking too sensible at this stage. Do you feel, because I kind of do, that maybe the cleansing fire of a massive bubble pop in the InfoSec funding market could actually be quite good for us?
Oh, I absolutely think it'll be good for us. Like, I think it can't come soon enough. And one of the bad slides on that thing, the thing that says that actually the one of the problems that I see VCs bringing is they prolong this necessary learning where we should learn that a product is bad in a shorter cycle because they VC funded to the tune of 30 or 32 million. It means that we're going to have to put up with this company spewing
until they actually run out of money. Yeah,
exactly. And so the actual problem there is that the market gets confused because this company sticks around longer than they should. Like insiders know that's junk, don't touch it. But you keep seeing the product pop up in different places. And yeah, the sooner that dies, the better.
Well, Haroon Mia, as I said, I think everybody should watch this talk. It's on YouTube, and I have put a link in this week's show notes. I really enjoyed it, and I think that for a lot of people out there, they need to see it, right? Like, this is stuff you need to know. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and we're actually going to do this again, I think, in the last show for the year in December. So I'm going to chat to you again in about 6 weeks.
Sounds good. Always cool. Thanks for having me, Pat.
That was Haroon Mia of Thinkst Canary there. Big thanks to him for that. And huge thanks to Thinkst for being a Risky Business sponsor for some years now. That is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with a Soapbox edition of the podcast. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.